This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
A juror named Laura went on Good Morning America after the trial of Corey Richens and described her first impression of Corey Richens. Kind of interesting to hear. The first thing we hear is these terrible things about her. This is what Laura, the juror, said. And she's just sitting there, like all by herself. At first, I was thinking that Corey was definitely feeling trapped. First impressions of someone you don't know anything about. By the time the verdict came, guilty on all counts, roughly 3 hours of deliberation, Lori described Corey differently, like a statue. Almost no reaction, even as the judge read the word guilty on charge after charge after charge. The distance between feeling trapped and like a statue is the entire psychological journey of this trial, not the jury's journey, Corey's. And I think this episode is the one that really cracks open how broken her internal system really is, because for 3 weeks, the thing she relies on most to function was taken away from her. And what was left when you strip away all of that? It tells you everything. The trial started February 23rd, 2026 in Sema County. It was expected to last through late March. It didn't need that long. Both sides rested. The defense called zero witnesses. Corey waived her right to testify. The jury came back unanimous in roughly 3 hours. But what matters for this episode isn't the evidence or the verdict. It's the 3 weeks in between. What it felt like inside the psychology we've been mapping across this entire series. To sit in your chair and watch your constructed reality get dismantled in public, piece by piece, by people you can't redirect, and evidence you can't rewrite, Corey. As we go through part four here in our series, be sure to press subscribe wherever it is you're listening or watching, and then give us your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Those links are in the description. Let's start with a defense strategy, because it's all it's the first collision point here. Zero witnesses, no defense case for a woman who's spent years constructing and defending an alternative narrative with a children's book, TV appearances, letters from jail, messages to admirers about exposing the system, being told by her own attorneys that the best strategy is to stay, just say nothing, just shut up. Must have landed like a hand around her throat, really. I mean, not silence as a legal tactic, silence as the direct negation of everything her psychology requires to function. It's probably why we got a 40-minute diatribe at the end. It was all bottling up. She's probably taking notes the whole time for that speech. Her attorneys likely concluded that any witness or testimony would just open doors that needed to stay closed. Legally defensible, but consider what that advice sounded like inside Corey's head. The people she hired to tell her story decided her story was a liability. They were not rejecting the prosecution's case. They were, in effect, rejecting hers. And she had to accept it. She had to sit down. She had to stay quiet for 3 weeks. The woman who produced stories the way most people produce breathing reflexively, automatically, under every kind of pressure, was told to stop producing and comply. Imagine what those 3 weeks felt like from inside of Corey Richens' mind. Not as a legal proceeding, as a sustained psychological event, day after day. Witnesses from her own life took the stand and told a story about her that she could not control, could not correct, could not redirect. Each witness peeled back another layer of the identity she'd built. She had to absorb it in silence in a chair while the room watched. And we saw her reactions to it all. Utter rejection of the opinions of any human being around her that directly conflicted with her own. Shock, outrage, disgust is all we got from Corey the whole trial. Anytime anybody said anything, but the second somebody said, "Oh my God, you make the best chicken stew in a crock pot," oh, Corey lit up like a Christmas tree. A radioactive Christmas tree stolen from a family in Chernobyl. But still a Christmas tree, nonetheless, being plugged into the wrong type of outlet 40-some years after the disaster, missing all of its needles. But still, a one-time a Christmas tree, right? Carmen Lauber, the housekeeper, testified about selling Corey the fentanyl, a woman from Corey's own life, someone she employed, someone she trusted enough to ask for street drugs, sitting across a courtroom and narrating the transaction. For most defendants, that is devastating because of the legal implications themselves. For Corey, the damage is a little different. This is someone from her world stepping outside her narrative and telling a version of events she can't manage. The first crack in the wall of the story, she thought that she controlled. Then Josh Grossman took the stand and wept. The text messages are projected for the courtroom, the private world, the sealed room where she was building her next life, displayed on screens for 12 strangers to read. He described how Corey asked him 2 weeks after Eric's death whether he had ever taken someone's life. He described the trucks she bought him, the flip houses he lived in, the plans they made for a future that depended on Eric not having one and basically being her indentured servant. Every detail from Grossman's testimony was the interior of a room Corey had kept locked, being opened for public inspection. And she could only watch. She didn't like it. Think about what that feels like. From her seat at the defense table, a man she allegedly loved or used or needed or both, becoming emotional about their relationship in front of people who will decide whether she lives in prison forever. His testimony isn't just about an affair. It's about the texture of her deception, the money she spent on him, the questions she asked, the texts where she mapped out a future and required her husband's absence. The most private relationship in her life narrated for strangers while she sat in mandated silence and could not say a single word. The forensic accounting may have been the most psychologically damaging testimony of all, though, because it didn't challenge what Corey did. It challenged who she was. Black and white, numbers, don't lie. There ain't no conjecture here. Brooke Carrington spent an entire day walking the jury through the financial reality behind the projected image. The $4.5 million in debt, the business that was collapsing, the high interest loans, the properties that weren't generating what Corey told people they were generating. For someone whose entire self-concept was built on being the girl who grew up scrubbing rich people's toilets and crawled her way to owning those same houses, having that image revealed as a fiction built on debt, it was not just humiliating, it was annihilating. The person she told the world she was, the person she needed to be for the rest of her psychology to function, was dismantled with spreadsheets in front of everyone. Day after day, witness after witness, friends testifying she'd said things would be better if Eric were dead. The gap between the constructed identity and the documented reality projected on screen side by side, the successful businesswoman crushed by debt, the devoted mother, a woman who chose money and a boyfriend over her family, the grieving widow identified as the person who searched for lethal doses of fentanyl, acquired it from her housekeeper and served it up in a cocktail, and nobody stood up to defend her. That absence has to be understood psychologically, not just legally. The defense called zero witnesses. Nobody from her life took the stand to say she was a good person, that she was incapable of this, that the prosecution had it all wrong. Not her mother, not her sister, not her brother, not a single living soul. The people who would later at sentencing call her glue of the family and promise her that her innocence would shine too brightly to be contained. Some of y'all using ChatGPT too much. None of them testified. Whether that was a legal decision or a practical one, the psychological experience for Corey is pretty much the same. She sat through 3 weeks of dismantled testimony, of being dismantled, of dismantlement. Nobody came to rebuild her. And through all of it, silence, unable to object in her own voice, unable to explain, unable to redirect, unable to produce the one thing her psychology has always relied on to survive: a story. So what does that do to a mind built on narrative production? Well, the reflex we talked about in the last episode, the automatic story generating mechanism that fires under every threat, was being triggered constantly. Every witness was a threat. Every piece of evidence was a threat. Every day in that courtroom was a sustained assault on her self-image. And that reflex, the reflex was firing over and over, generating responses, defenses, explanations, stories. But they had nowhere to go. The attorneys had closed the valve. The stories are being produced, but couldn't be released. Corey was a pipe bomb waiting to explode. 3 weeks of narrative pressure building behind a closed capsule. The result, visible to the courtroom, was what that juror described: a statue. Not calm, not stoic, not strategically composed, a system in overload, a circuit breaker, tripped by information too threatening for the self structure to process. The machinery that usually produces charm, emotional display, narrative construction, offline. Not because she'd accepted what was happening, because the system had no program for this scenario. She'd never been in a room where she couldn't control the story and couldn't leave. And the only response the system could produce was nothing. Freeze. Go still. Wait for it to stop. Then came her Google searches projected on the screen, misspelled, typo-written, raw. What is a lethal dot dose dot of fet dot fentanyl? If someone is poisoned, what does it go down on the death certificate as? The simplicity is really kind of stunning. Well, they were poisoned, Bill, so on the death certificate, we got to put down it was a toxic combo of no-no juice and Corey sauce. The hell do you think it goes down on the death certificate as, you idiot? Luxury prisons for the rich in America. Another fine search. These searches were the one room she never showed anyone. The planning room, the awareness room, the room that contradicted every other version of herself. And now 12 strangers were reading its contents out loud, word by misspelled word. Well, she sat in a chair and could not speak. The typos deserve a little attention, not as evidence, but I think almost as psychology. Fentanyl, period. Poisoned, period. These aren't the searches of someone being careful, someone deliberate, someone who Googled these terms with the clinical precision of a premeditated killer. These are the searches of someone typing fast, thinking faster, fingers outrunning spelling, urgency visible in every keystroke. The person behind those typos can't calmly be researching. She was scrambling, checking, and reassuring herself in the rawness of those misspellings displayed on a courtroom screen for everyone to see, strips away the composure she'd maintained for 4 years. This is the unedited version. The one she never intended anyone to read. And she had to watch 12 strangers absorb all of it. The verdict came in March 16th. Guilty on all counts. Aggravated murder. Aggravated attempted murder. Insurance fraud. Forgery. Unanimous. 3 hours. We think you're a piece of shit, Corey. Go back to the hell which you hath come from. Okay, that part wasn't part of the, you know, jury's response. But, you know, I'm thinking probably in their souls that's how they felt. 3 hours. In a case it took 3 weeks to present, the jury needed less than a business afternoon. They had a roundtable talk through the evidence and their reactions and arrived at the same conclusion without significant disagreement. Not a single holdout, not one juror who saw it her way. The narrative she'd built for 4 years, the book, the TV tour, the emails, the proclamations of innocence, the fictional novel, the messages about exposing the corrupt system, all of it weighed and dismissed. The time it takes to watch a movie. For anyone whose internal reality has been, I'm innocent, this is a persecution, and when the truth comes out, I'll be vindicated, the speed is the hardest thing. Not the word guilty, the 3 hours. Because it means she wasn't a hard question. She wasn't ambiguous. She wasn't even close. The story she'd been living inside since March 4th, 2022 was considered and discarded in a fraction of an afternoon. Laura, the juror, said Corey showed almost no reaction when the verdict was read, like a statue. That makes sense now. Not composure, not acceptance. A system that has no code for this input. The machinery that would generate tears, shock, anger, defiance, none of it running. Because processing the verdict would require acknowledging that the constructed reality is false, and that acknowledgement would collapse the self-destructive, the whole self-structure. So the system does the only thing it can, nothing. It freezes like the screen going dark when the processor overheats. But freezes are temporary. The processor cools down, the system restarts, and when it did, when Corey Richards was finally given a microphone and Control-Alt-Delete had been pressed enough times, restart! Oh, there it comes. Everybody's, can everybody hear the Windows XP sound or Windows 95 booting up? Yeah, I didn't quite know if she's that advanced. I'm thinking more like 3.1, just silence. The first time she'd been allowed to speak publicly since the trial began, everything that had been compressed during those three silent weeks, everything the verdict had attempted to close, everything the psychological machinery had been storing behind the valve her attorneys installed, all of it came out. The reflex that had been firing uselessly for 3 weeks, generating defenses that had nowhere to go other than her notepad, producing stories that couldn't be delivered, finally had an outlet, and the pressure that had accumulated behind the silence didn't produce a measured statement or a plea for mercy. It produced a flood. For 45 minutes on what would have been her dead husband's 44th birthday, to an abundance, or rather to an audience that included three boys who'd asked the judge to put their mother away forever. The air left that room and hasn't come back. And that's next. Press subscribe so you don't miss the story of that cornucopia of chaos. Another inlet in the fractured brain of Corey Richens. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'll continue our conversation there. And like I said, press subscribe so you don't miss the last part of our story on Corey Richens. The last story she'll ever tell. It's coming up next. Until then, my name's Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.